Chapter 31. Naples. It wakes again to Policinelli and pickpockets, buffo singers and beggars, rags, puppets, flowers, brightness, dirt, and universal degradation, airing its harlequin suit in the sunshine, next day and every day, singing, starving, dancing, gaming, on the seashore, and leaving all labor to the burning mountain, which is ever at its work. Our English dilettanti would be very pathetic on the subject of the national taste if they could hear an Italian opera half as badly sung in England as we may hear the Foscari performed tonight in the splendid theater of San Carlo. But, for astonishing truth and spirit in seizing and embodying the real life about it, the shabby little San Carlino theater, the rickety house one story high, with a staring picture outside. Down among the drums and trumpets, and the tumblers, and the lady conjurer is without a rival anywhere. There is one extraordinary feature in the real life of Naples, at which we may take a glance, before we go to lotteries. They prevail in most parts of Italy, but are particularly obvious, in their effects and influences, here. They are drawn every Saturday. They bring an immense revenue to the government, and diffuse a taste for gambling among the poorest of the poor, which is very comfortable to the coffers of the state, and very ruinous to themselves. The lowest stake is 1 grain, less than a farthing. 100 numbers from 1 to 100, inclusive, are put into a box. 5 are drawn. Those are the prizes. I buy 3 numbers. If one of them come up, I win a small prize. If 2, some hundreds of times my stake. If 3, 3,500 times my stake. I stake, or play as they call it, what I can upon my numbers, and by what numbers I please. The amount I play, I pay at the lottery office, where I purchase the ticket, and it is stated on the ticket itself. Every lottery office keeps a printed book, an universal lottery diviner, where every possible accident and circumstance is provided for, and has a number against it. For instance, let us take 2 carlini about 7 pence. On our way to the lottery office, we run against a black man. When we get there, we say gravely, "The diviner." Apostrophe, it is handed over the counter, as a serious matter of business. We look at black man. Such a number. Give us that. Apostrophe, we look at running against a person in the street. Give us that. Apostrophe, we look at the name of the street itself. Give us that. Apostrophe, now, we have our 3 numbers. If the roof of the theater of San Carlo were to fall in, so many people would play upon the numbers attached to such an accident in the diviner, that the government would soon close those numbers, and decline to run the risk of losing any more upon them. This often happens. Not long ago, when there was a fire in the king's palace, there was such a desperate run on fire, and king, and palace, that further stakes on the numbers attached to those words in the golden book were forbidden. Every accident or event is supposed, by the ignorant populace, to be a revelation to the beholder, or party concerned, in connection with the lottery. Certain people who have a talent for dreaming, fortunately, are much sought after, and there are some priests who are constantly favored with visions of the lucky numbers. I heard of a horse running away with a man, and dashing him down, dead, at the corner of a street. Pursuing the horse with incredible speed, was another man, who ran so fast, that he came up, immediately after the accident. He threw himself upon his knees beside the unfortunate rider, and clasped his hand with an expression of the wildest grief. "If you have life, apostrophe," he said, "speak 1 word to me. If you have 1 gasp of breath left, mention your age for heaven's sake, that I may play that number in the lottery. Apostrophe, it is 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we may go to see our lottery drawn." The ceremony takes place every Saturday, in the tribunal, or court of justice, this singular earthy-smelling room, or gallery, as moldy as an old cellar, and as damp as a dungeon. At the upper end is a platform, with a large horseshoe table upon it, and a president and counsel sitting round all judges of the law. The man on the little stool behind the president is the Capo Lazarin, a kind of tribune of the people, appointed on their behalf, to see that all is fairly conducted. Attended by a few personal friends. A ragged, swarthy fellow he is, with long matted hair hanging down all over his face, and covered, from head to foot, with most unquestionably genuine dirt. All the body of the room is filled with the commonest of the Neapolitan people, and between them and the platform, guarding the steps leading to the ladder, is a small body of soldiers. There is some delay in the arrival of the necessary number of judges, during which, the box, in which the numbers are being placed, is a source of the deepest interest. When the box is full, the boy who is to draw the numbers out of it becomes the prominent feature of the proceedings. He is already dressed for his part, in a tight brown holland coat, with only one, the left, sleeve to it, which leaves his right arm bared to the shoulder, ready for plunging down into the mysterious chest. During the hush and whisper that pervade the room, all eyes are turned on this young minister of fortune. People begin to inquire his age, with a view to the next lottery, and the number of his brothers and sisters, and the age of his father and mother, and whether he has any moles or pimples upon him, and where, and how many, when the arrival of the last judge, but one, a little old man, universally dreaded as possessing the evil eye, makes a slight diversion, and would occasion a greater one, but that he is immediately deposed, as a source of interest, by the officiating priest, who advances gravely to his place, followed by a very dirty little boy, carrying his sacred vestments, and a pot of holy water. Here is the last judge come at last, and now he takes his place at the horseshoe table. There is a murmur of irrepressible agitation. In the midst of it, the priest puts his head into the sacred vestments, and pulls the same over his shoulders. Then he says a silent prayer, and dipping a brush into the pot of holy water, sprinkles it over the box, and over the boy, and gives them a double-barreled blessing, which the box and the boy are both hoisted on the table to receive. The boy remaining on the table, the box is now carried round the front of the platform, by an attendant, who holds it up, and shakes it lustily all the time, seeming to say, like the conjurer, "There is no deception, ladies and gentlemen, keep your eyes upon me, if you please." At last, the box is set before the boy, and the boy, first holding up his naked arm and open hand, dives down into the hole it is made like a ballot box, and pulls out a number, which is rolled up, round something hard, like a bonbon. This he hands to the judge next him, who unrolls a little bit, and hands it to the president, next to whom he sits. The president unrolls it, very slowly. The Capo Lazarin leans over his shoulder. The president holds it up, unrolled, to the Capo Lazarin. The Capo Lazarin, looking at it eagerly, cries out, in a shrill, loud voice, "Sesantadu!" 62, expressing the two upon his fingers, as he calls it out. Alas, the Capo Lazarin himself has not staked on 62. His face is very long, and his eyes roll wildly. As it happens to be a favorite number, however, it is pretty well received, which is not always the case. They are all drawn with the same ceremony, omitting the blessing. One blessing is enough for the whole multiplication table. The only new incident in the proceedings is the gradually deepening intensity of the change in the Capo Lazarin, who has, evidently, speculated to the very utmost extent of his means, and who, when he sees the last number, and finds that it is not one of his, clasps his hands, and raises his eyes to the ceiling before proclaiming it, as though remonstrating, in a secret agony, with his patron saint, for having committed so gross a breach of confidence. I hope the Capo Lazarin may not desert him for some other member of the calendar, but he seems to threaten it. Where the winners may be, nobody knows. They certainly are not present, the general disappointment filling one with pity for the poor people. They look, when we stand aside, observing them, in their passage through the courtyard down below, as miserable as the prisoners in the gaol. It forms a part of the building, who are peeping down upon them, from between their bars, or, as the fragments of human heads which are still dangling in chains outside, in memory of the good old times, when their owners were strung up there, for the popular edification. Away from Naples, in a glorious sunrise, by the road to Capua, and then on a 3 days' journey along by roads, that we may see, on the way, the monastery of Monte Cassino, which is perched on the steep and lofty hill above the little town of San Germano, and is lost on a misty morning in the clouds. So much the better, for the deep sounding of its bell, which, as we go winding up, on mules, towards the convent, is heard mysteriously in the still air, while nothing is seen but the gray mist, moving solemnly and slowly, like a funeral procession. Behold, at length the shadowy pile of building close before us, its gray walls and towers dimly seen, though so near and so vast, and the raw vapor rolling through its cloisters heavily. There are two black shadows walking to and fro in the quadrangle, near the statues of the patron saint and his sister, and hopping on behind them, in and out of the old arches, is a raven, croaking in answer to the bell, and uttering, at intervals, the purest Tuscan. How like a Jesuit he looks! There never was a sly and stealthy fellow so at home as is this raven, standing now at the refectory door, with his head on one side, and pretending to glance another way, while he is scrutinizing the visitors keenly, and listening with fixed attention. What a dull-headed monk the porter becomes in comparison! He speaks like us. Apostrophe, apostrophe, says the porter. Quite as plainly. Apostrophe, quite as plainly, porter. Nothing could be more expressive than his reception of the peasants who are entering the gate with baskets and burdens. There is a roll in his eye, and a chuckle in his throat, which should qualify him to be chosen superior of an order of ravens. He knows all about it. It's all right, apostrophe, he says. We know what we know. Come along, good people. Glad to see you. Apostrophe, how was this extraordinary structure ever built in such a situation, where the labor of conveying the stone, and iron, and marble, so great a height, must have been prodigious? Caw! Apostrophe, says the raven, welcoming the peasants. How, being despoiled by plunder, fire, and earthquake, has it risen from its ruins, and been again made, what we now see it, with its church, so sumptuous and magnificent? Caw! Apostrophe, says the raven, welcoming the peasants. These people have a miserable appearance, and, as usual, are densely ignorant, and all beg, while the monks are chanting in the chapel. Caw! Apostrophe, apostrophe, says the raven, cuckoo! Apostrophe, so we leave him, chuckling and rolling his eye at the convent gate, and wind slowly down again through the cloud. At last emerging from it, we come in sight of the village far below, and the flat green country intersected by rivulets, which is pleasant and fresh to see after the obscurity and haze of the convent, no disrespect to the raven, or the holy friars. Away we go again, by muddy roads, and through the most shattered and tattered of villages, where there is not a whole window among all the houses, or a whole garment among all the peasants, or the least appearance of anything to eat, in any of the wretched huckster's shops. The women wear a bright red bodice laced before and behind, a white skirt, and the Neapolitan headdress of square folds of linen, primitively meant to carry loads on. The men and children wear anything they can get. The soldiers are as dirty and rapacious as the dogs. The inns are such hobgoblin places that they are infinitely more attractive and amusing than the best hotels in Paris. Here is one near Valmontan.
That is Valmontan around.
Wall town on the mount opposite, which is approached by a quagmire almost knee-deep. There is a wild colonnade below, and a dark yard full of empty stables and lofts, and a great long kitchen with a great long bench and a great long form, where a party of travelers, with two priests among them, are crowding round the fire, while their supper is cooking. Above stairs, is a rough brick gallery to sit in, with very little windows with very small patches of knotty glass in them, and all the doors, that open from it a dozen or two, off their hinges, and a bare board on trestles for a table, at which 30 people might dine easily, and a fireplace large enough in itself for a breakfast parlor, where, as the faggots blaze and crackle, they illuminate the ugliest and grimmest of faces, drawn in charcoal on the whitewashed chimney sides by previous travelers. There is a flaring country lamp on the table, and, hovering about it, scratching her thick black hair continually, a yellow dwarf of a woman, who stands on tiptoe, to arrange the hatchet knives, and takes a flying leap to look into the water jug. The beds in the adjoining rooms are of the liveliest kind. There is not a solitary scrap of looking glass in the house, and the washing apparatus is identical with the cooking utensils. But the yellow dwarf sets on the table a good flask of excellent wine, holding a quart at least, and produces, among half a dozen other dishes, two-thirds of a roasted kid, smoking hot. She is as good-humored too, as dirty, which is saying a great deal. So here's long life to her, in the flask of wine, and prosperity to the establishment. Rome gained and left behind, and with it the pilgrims who are now repairing to their own homes again each with his scallop shell and staff, and soliciting alms for the love of God we come, by a fair country, to the falls of Terni, where the whole Velino River dashes, headlong, from a rocky height, amidst shining spray and rainbows. Perugia, strongly fortified by art and nature, on the lofty eminence, rising abruptly from the plain, where purple mountains mingle with the distant sky, is glowing, on its market day, with radiant colors. They set off its somber, but rich Gothic buildings admirably. The pavement of its marketplace is strewn with country goods. All along the steep hill leading from the town, under the town wall, there is a noisy fair of calves, lambs, pigs, horses, mules, and oxen. Fowls, geese, and turkeys flutter vigorously among their very hoofs, and buyers, sellers, and spectators, clustering everywhere, block up the road as we come shouting down upon them. Suddenly, there is a ringing sound among our horses. The driver stops them. Sinking in his saddle, and casting up his eyes to heaven, he delivers this apostrophe, O Jove omnipotent! Here is a horse has lost his shoe. ! Notwithstanding the tremendous nature of this accident, and the utterly forlorn look and gesture impossible in anyone but an Italian vetturino, with which it is announced, it is not long in being repaired by a mortal farrier, by whose assistance we reach Castiglione in the same night, and Arezzo next day. Mass is, of course, performing in its fine cathedral, where the sun shines in among the clustered pillars, through rich stained glass windows, half revealing, half concealing the kneeling figures on the pavement, and striking out paths of spotted light in the long aisles. But, how much beauty of another kind is here, when, on a fair clear morning, we look, from the summit of a hill, on Florence. See where it lies before us in a sunlighted valley, bright with the winding Arno, and shut in by swelling hills, its domes, and towers, and palaces, rising from the rich country in a glittering heap, and shining in the sun like gold. Magnificently stern and somber are the streets of beautiful Florence, and the strong old piles of building make such heaps of shadow, on the ground and in the river, that there is another, and a different city of rich forms and fancies, always lying at our feet. Prodigious palaces, constructed for defense, with small distrustful windows heavily barred, and walls of great thickness formed of huge masses of rough stone, frown, in their old sulky state, on every street. In the midst of the city, in the piazza of the Grand Duke, adorned with beautiful statues and the fountain of Neptune, rises the Palazzo Vecchio, with its enormous overhanging battlements, and the great tower that watches over the whole town. In its courtyard, worthy of the castle of Otranto, in its ponderous gloom is a massive staircase that the heaviest wagon and the stoutest team of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.